This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Follow a Standard Orbit, Mr. Chekhov, and take us home.
Hi, sir.
It is the word of Landru.
Joy to you, friends, and thanks for joining us here in Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated show to the original series. My name is Drew, or Landru, and this is my co-host Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Mike. I'm good. And today, we have a very special guest, John Tenuto.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're doing well. Thanks for joining us. You know, hey. I mean, like last week, we talked up how great your presentations were, and there have been, I mean, like I saw a thing on Twitter, you know, where, you know, someone was like, hey, you know what, everyone keeps on talking about these talks, and you know, I never get to see them because I'm in London or whatever, you know. And you know, we talked about how the Star Trek VI presentation was the best thing at the con and all that stuff. So,
you were voted number one by the Schindler.
Yeah, by me. So,
oh my gosh! Wow.
No problem. No, thank you. Thank you for the informative talk. But yeah, we figured, you know what, Star Trek VI, it's one of those things where it kind of gets lost in the shuffle sometimes, especially since it's the best of the original six movies.
Right.
Yeah. So, in my humble opinion. So, so we figured who better to talk to than John. So, thank you very much. So, this...
I'll send that the check to you guys soon.
Okay. Don't we have to pay you because you charge money for these talks and then we're getting it for free?
No, funny, I don't charge, so they're free. They're always free. But I get, you know, I might get a piece of cake for free or something after.
Oh, that's good. That's something.
I get paid in food.
Oh, that's good. You could get one of those little like squid things that they, no,
yeah.
The rubber squid. Yeah.
the Klingon dinner.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, I guess my first question would be like, this is a movie which had a very rocky start. This is not what Star Trek VI was originally going to be. And, you know, one of the things which I was saying last week to Drew, like when I was listening to your talk in Vegas, I'm like, man, and you were like kind of like laying out the time frame and everything. And I'm like, wow, you know, maybe people shouldn't be so worried about Star Trek Beyond, because this is a leisurely production next to what was going on with Star Trek VI. But what was it, for those people who don't know, what was the original plan for Star Trek VI? I mean, okay, Star Trek V comes out, everyone loves it, and then, you know, they know that the 25th anniversary is coming up. So what happens next?
Well, you know, there was a bunch of you know, activities planned for the 25th anniversary. You know, they're going to have the handprints in the cement outside of Grauman's Chinese Theater, and Creation planned the first time ever you would have Shatner and Nimoy touring. And they did this big 25-year mission tour together, and they were on, you know, stage for 2 hours. And there are all these different events planned, but you know, of course, as fans, you know, one of the best ways to celebrate the anniversary of any Star Trek milestone is a new movie. And, you know, we got that, you know, in coming up next year with the 50th anniversary. So, you know, there are some interesting parallels between a troubled production, you know, certainly in the ramp up and script department for Star Trek Beyond and Star Trek VI. So, but the idea of them celebrating the 25th anniversary with a movie is actually on the mind of Harv Bennett back at the time of Star Trek IV, when it was the 20th anniversary. And knowing that the 25th was coming around, knowing that IV was, you know, looking like it was going to be a big success, you know, he's beginning to think, well, what can we do for the 25th anniversary. And Ralph Winter, who produced, you know, many of the original Star Trek films, gone on to produce some of the Marvel movies and things like that, he had an idea that why don't we do a prequel? Although that word really wasn't in our vocabulary too much back then, but, you know, we had had like one or two prequels, right? You know, sort of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and that kind of thing at that era. And what if we did a prequel where we go back in time and see how Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and the rest of the crew met each other and come up with this movie that ultimately becomes Star Trek, The First Adventure. And, you know, Harve Bennett likes that idea. For, you know, for a couple reasons. One is the reality of the crew aging. And the original plan, which was to introduce David and Savick as sort of replacement characters, bringing in a next generation, if you will, didn't work out in the movies. And so there was this sort of looming problem of eventually, what are you going to do to keep the movie franchise going with the original characters? And so the idea was to do sort of two movies. One would have been a traditional Star Trek sequel, a Star Trek 5, 6, whatever the number would be at that time, 5 years from now in 1991, but also do this prequel film. And initially, the studio and the executives liked the idea of it. Some got skittish when they learned that Shatner and you know, Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly wouldn't be in it. And so they crafted an intro where the main cast would be sitting around and then reminisce. So they would be in the movie, but really the bulk of the film, 95% of it, would be telling the story of, you know, oh, remember when we were kids. And I had a chance to read that script by David Lowery, who wrote the script of Star Trek V, wrote this script. And it is a really good script. I think it would have been an interesting film. It was about, Kirk. It opens up, coincidentally, fairly similar to Star Trek 2009, where you have Kirk basically flying a plane. Daredevil, you know, stunt plane, test plane kind of thing, in a cornfield in Iowa. And you get introduced to Kirk, and Kirk is going to the academy, and at the academy he meets McCoy. And then there's the Spock character. And one of the interesting things is Spock really faces discrimination and prejudice on campus because he's different. And there's this sort of growing movement against green bloods, against people who aren't red-blooded, really who aren't human. And it's among a small group of people, but it's vocal enough that they're becoming dangerous. And one of the people who leads this movement, it turns out, is this Starfleet cadet who is also a prince gave up his, you know, prince status on his homeworld to come to Starfleet. When he gets basically drummed out of Starfleet, he, you know, goes back to that world. And so the film is really about prejudice, discrimination, how we deal with it. There's a pretty funny scene when they're all in the bar and Spock kind of gets drunk, and it's got very cute moments, but it's not a humorous film at all. It's much more serious, and, you know, it deals with very Star Trek based themes. And then, of course, by the end of the film, Kirk, Spock, Scotty, and McCoy are on board a ship called the Enterprise, not the Enterprise we know, and they're part of this sort of, you know, space battle, the action adventure sequence that occurs. So that was the script. And right around 1990, the plug is pulled on that movie. Now, they've done the script. They've done some pre-production drawings, things like that. They've started to do location scouting. But the plug is pulled because the idea is, no, let's just do a traditional movie. We want to do a traditional movie with the original crew, and that's that. So they offer Star Trek VI to Harve Bennett again and say, well, look, why don't we do it this way? Let's do the Star Trek VI traditional. Then we'll come back after that and do this Star Trek, The First Adventure. And Harve Bennett has said that his feeling was that was just sort of like, we're going to tell you that, and we're probably not going to be able to do it, or we're not going to want to do it. And because they, you know, Next Gen was going to then be kind of coming up to take over the film franchise. So he was asked to do Star Trek VI and head it like he had done 2 through 5, but he declined the offer. And so here it is. It's May 1990. And, you know, you only have till December 31st, 1991 to release a movie, and it's, you know, and call it a 25th anniversary film. And they have no script, no director, no producer, no writer, no nothing.
So that's only like 19 months. But hang on, let's go back and touch on a couple of things that you mentioned already. First off, I had never heard this, but I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense. But you're saying like David, Marcus, and Savick were kind of being groomed as sort of like replacement characters for the original series crew?
Well, to be, yeah, I mean, the idea was certainly Savick was a replacement for Spock, right? Spock wasn't going to be in any of the films, right?
Yeah,
and David, the idea basically was that as the characters aged and or if they chose not to do a film, because, I mean, we, in a way, we were really spoiled as fans. It is extraordinary that we got the original actors, all of them, for so long, you know, to play those roles. And really, where else does that happen? And when we had a shift like with Savick, where you had Robin Curtis taking over for a role, you know, even that didn't sit well with us. We had trouble accepting that idea because we had been so used to that realism. You know, it's not Batman, it's not Superman, where new, you know, even James Bond, where new actors come in and you accept that it's part of that world. And so, you know, very much the design of David and was always to be, there was always a generational theme, even from the very beginning outline of Harv Bennett back in 1980, where he called the War of the Generations. I mean, the whole idea of it being a generational thing and bringing in this younger group that would be able to kind of maybe carry the action and adventure part, you know, where maybe Kirk and Spock would be more on a ship action, you know, but, you know, like in Star Trek VI, right? There's a very little physical action that's required of anybody really beyond Kirk. Most of the other action is carried through the ships themselves, or you know, through dogfights in space, and so seeing where that was kind of where the franchise was going, the idea was to bring in these younger characters who were meant. I mean, you know, that's the theme of two, right? Everybody's got a son or a daughter, right? Spock's got a symbolic daughter. Kirk has an actual son, and Khan has, depending on who you want to believe, an actual or a symbolic son with Yalcom, and so. That whole idea of bringing in that younger generation thematically worked for the film, but it was also there as a practical purpose of, hey, this can be the, you know, David was going to be the guy to run around and, you know, do things. And what happened is when the idea was, you know, three was going to be about bringing Spock back, then Harv Bennett felt that they didn't necessarily need all those characters. And although Savick was probably meant to continue, you know, David was sacrificed and Carol was not even featured in the script.
So, okay. My second question here would be in regards to the sort of like the early years script, or what was it called? Was it called Starfleet Academy?
The first adventure was the there were several titles, but that was the one that kind of stuck with the production.
Okay. Yeah. We talked about that a long time ago on this show because we didn't read the script, but we read a description of the script that someone put up online. And it does really seem very much like Star Trek 09 in a lot of ways. But I guess the idea of it being around the time of Star Trek 4 that this idea was formulated does make a lot of sense, because you don't really think about it in the historical context, but you know, that would have been pre Next Generation. Like a lot of these problems that they seem to be trying to tackle by doing like a reboot essentially of the original series and everything, a lot of those problems are solved by bringing in the Next Generation. So I can see kind of the studio's reluctance to do this, because it's almost, there's almost no point to it,
Yeah, without having proved that you could do the next generation, how could you do the previous generations?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, next gen isn't announced really until Star Trek IV is, you know, in people's consciousness, you know, and is successful and know that looks like it's going to be successful. And, you know, the other element of that is, yeah, there is similarities between 2009. I think those similarities, though, are probably inevitable similarities. I would be very surprised if they even looked at the script for 2009, because it certainly is very, very different. There's no Romulan, there's no Nero, there's no Prime Universe Spock or anything like that in the first adventure script. There's a few scenes where, you know, I know Harv Bennett kind of was suspicious,
yeah.
You know. But and he had mentioned that, you know, that one of the reasons he didn't like it was he felt that these scenes, but I think these scenes sort of existed in the script. But, you know, yeah, the crop dusting scene and the car stealing scene are similar. The ages of the characters, though, are very different, and the motivations are different. And there is a bar scene, but it's again very, very different. And really, the first adventure script takes place quite a bit on Earth, and then in the sort of second half is in space, where, and, you know, they really get into space pretty quick in Star Trek 2009, and the whole plot, there's absolutely no Romulans, and Vulcan isn't destroyed or anything like that. So I mean, it's different, and I think the comparisons that Harv Bennett might have seen, I think, were almost the inevitable things, right? If you have Iowa in a movie, but yet you want it to be in the, you know, 23rd century. You do something to kind of jazz it up, you know, and so you have, you know, it's something we're not used to seeing, a regular car in Star Trek, you know, but then it's of course followed by a robot on a, you know, robot policeman or whatever he is, who, you know, talks to little Kirk. Same thing in this script where, you know, you make a little bit futuristic. And so, It is a really good script, though. I mean, I have to say I enjoyed reading it, and I could see it have been made. And I think that good actors could have done some good things with it. There were some nice moments in it. And you see, you know, Kirk and Spock, there isn't the animosity at the start, really, that there is in this script. But it's, in 2009, but it's, you know, it takes a while for them to all sort of learn to cooperate with each other and work together as a team. It's a really good script. I wish someone had done a book on it or something like that, you know, maybe made a novelization of it.
Hey, these days, why not? Why not get IDW to come in and adapt it into a comic, yeah. You know?
Yeah, why not do all of them? Do God Thing and, you know, yeah. do all the ones that we should have seen, you know?
Absolutely, you know? I mean, geez, I missed opportunities. Anyway, I remember you were talking about, like, with good actors, and I know that Harv Bennett has talked about sort of his, I don't know if you could call it dream casting or whatever, but he was definitely thinking of, like, Ethan Hawke as Kirk and John Cusack as Spock.
That'd be
interesting. Mm-hmm. I could see it.
Especially I mean, certainly. Ethan Hawke.
Yeah. Oh, crazy. So, okay, so this idea is thrown away. And now you said that they were planning on doing both at the same time or both to come out that year, right? Like, when does when does that idea sort of go away, the idea of doing two movies?
Well, it's around April or May of 1990 that it's known that Harv isn't going to continue and that you're not going to get a Star Trek VI under his executive producer role. So Frank Mancuso, who was the Paramount chief at that time, calls Leonard Nimoy in May of 1990.
Wait, I'm sorry. Can we just go back for just one second? Did Harv Bennett have any plans for a Star Trek VI in the traditional sense? Aside from like saying like I want to make it, but did he have any like story ideas or anything?
No, not to our research. And I think part of that is because everything that he has said is that, you know, maybe he had a general theme or an idea that he wanted to do, but he really had put a lot of energy into this, you know, I mean, his heart was broken. This was going to be a great film, and he put his attention was on this Star Trek: The First Adventure. And I think his thinking was, no, we're going to make this thing first, then a traditional sequel. And that was going to be the order of things, which is why he put his energies into that movie first, you know, tackle movie one the first time. I think the studio's point of view was, no, they're kind of going to come out around the same time. Mm-hmm. There was a disconnect there. Obviously there were communication concerns, right? Because you have Paramount. I mean, you could totally understand Paramount's perspective, right? They're being told about this prequel idea, but have no idea you don't have Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly and so on in it. And so somebody somewhere is not fully communicating that information.
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were saying, I don't know, maybe if you can kind of start over your thought there just to make it clean for the edit or whatever. But so, okay. Sure. So there is no Academy movie, and we're at what point right now? Like, you're saying May of 1990?
May 1990. Okay. And, so Frank Mancuso calls Leonard Nimoy and asks if he will take on four roles, obviously act in another Star Trek film, direct it, produce it, executive produce it, and come up with a story, the idea of it as he had done for Star Trek IV. But adding, really, in Star Trek IV, adding the role of executive producer, which at that in Star Trek IV was filled by Harve Bennett. And Leonard Nimoy was committed to the idea of producing a 25th anniversary film. He liked that idea. He wanted there to be what I guess you could call a goodbye film, a farewell film that was focused on, the characters and saying a proper goodbye to them. And so he agreed with the caveat that's one hat too many. And that why don't we get Nicholas Meyer to direct bring him in, and we know that he can write and he can write quickly and we can talk story with him and that kind of thing. They say sure, and Leonard Nimoy goes off to Massachusetts in Provincetown. At this time, Nicholas Meyer's living in London with his family, but he's vacationing in Leonard Nimoy's home state of Massachusetts. And Leonard Nimoy calls and asks, I'd like to have a meeting with you. And he says, sure. And so they take a walk along the beach. And I never wanted to be a sea creature before, but I wish I could have been following them along in the ocean as they were walking, but the two of them just walked up and down the beach for about 2.5 hours. And, there were other ideas that were thrown out for Star Trek VI. One was an idea that Leonard Nimoy had that to bring both crews together, to bring the Next Generation and the original crews together. The problem that they had was the problem that existed even in Generations. That's an awful lot of characters to bring into one movie. How do you service all of them? How do you come up with a story that's plausible where the two crews are meeting one another? And so that idea is kind of dropped. And they start talking about, well, what can we do? And Leonard Nimoy's new idea was, let's go back to Star Trek's roots in being relevant to what's going on at that time, right? So back in 1986, April 1986, I believe it was, Chernobyl had occurred. And in those ensuing 4 years, the Soviet Union was starting to show the cracks, and the world was changing. And, I remember very much that optimism, I'm sure we all do, in the early 90s, that, hey, it's all okay now, right? It's all over. Communism's gone. There's no more enemies to fight, and everything's great. That Right Here, Right Now song is all about that, right? That whole world. And we never got that, of course. But, that was beginning. All that was starting around that period of time. And we had signed nuclear, disengagement treaties, and it was looking better. And so what if Star Trek commented on that? What if we used the Klingons, which had always sort of been a Cold War metaphor alien. What if we use them and we commented on what happens to people during the Cold War? And then so Nicholas Meyer, hearing that, immediately starts getting inspiration. So like, let's do Chernobyl in space. Let's do The Wall Comes Down in space. And it just sort of comes out of Nicholas Meyer. You know, let's comment on, you know, how would Kirk feel about this and all these sorts of issues. And this really, and a big theme at that time academically was whether there was any history left. You know, were we at the end of history? You know, a very postmodern question. Was there nothing that could be new anymore? And with the end of the Soviets, was that it? Was life just going to be kind of like, you know, after that? And that becomes a theme in there as well, brought in by Nicholas Meyer. Not that Nimoy and Meyer necessarily saw eye to eye on that script. I think Leonard Nimoy wanted a larger exploration of the actual Klingon culture, and for Nicholas Meyer and for Denny Martin Flynn, who write the script, it's a little bit more of a political thriller, which is still focused, you know, a little more on the Federation, and so. But that's where the idea of the script comes out of, and that's just a really interesting venue of the beach, and that's where the story comes out of. So Nicholas Meyer goes back to London, and his writing partner Denny Martin Flynn is in Los Angeles, and using email, which was obviously relatively new to most people at that time, they write the script via email back and forth with each other, and eventually come up with the script. The final version of their script is ready December 28th, 1990, which is less than 1 year before the movie's supposed to be in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, that time frame is crazy. I mean, when you think about that, it's like, okay, so they started this. They like asked him if it was in May of 1990, then that's like 19 months prior to release date. So
yeah.
The equivalent in Star Trek Beyond time would have been like January of this year, and we had a director and everything by January, right? So
yep,
plenty
yep.
of time. Although it sounds like the script writing process might have been, I don't know. Well, it is interesting hearing like Simon Pegg talk about writing the script now, and how he's saying like, well, we don't really have all the dialogue yet, but you know, whatever, we'll figure that out. That's easy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. The little birdies that are there, how much you can believe anybody's opinion on anything, because everyone's going to have their own opinion. But all I've heard is really good stuff from the people that are there or know enough about the production that, you know, to Justin Lin gets it. He knows what Star Trek is all about, and this is very much a Star Trek film. So I'm hoping, you know, and obviously you got Simon Pegg writing it. So at least, you know, half writing it. And so it's, I'm very hopeful that they're going to be able to do what, you know, I'm hoping for a repeat of Star Trek VI in the way of, you know, a great movie coming out, being born out of all of that limitations and struggles and restrictions.
Me too. So where are we? I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Oh yeah, I know what I was going to say. I know what I was going to say. If you read Nicholas Meyer's book, you know, View from the Bridge, you know, he talks about how he had just made a Cold War movie just prior to this called Company Business with Gene Hackman and Mikhail Baryshnikov, and how he kind of thought that he sort of messed that one up, and he saw this as sort of an opportunity to do it again, but good. And, I personally like Company Business quite a bit, but there's no doubt that Star Trek VI is the far better film, you know? So that's kind of cool. But yeah, okay, so we've got the script, and we're about to head into production. Is that where we're at now?
Yeah, and there's still going to be changes, important changes that are coming along. One is that, of course, once you have the final version of the script, you have to go through the budgeting process. And unfortunately, the budget, they had been told a certain amount, and the budget that came back was much lower. And in fact, the movie was canceled. In fact, a letter went out saying, you know, thank you all for all the work that you did. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to make the movie because we don't have the money to make this film. Agreements were reached, and they eventually got to a budget amount of $27 million, which, to kind of put that in context, was about the same exact budget as Star Trek V, which had been made several years earlier, and less than, if my memory serves, you know, either 3 to 6 million, somewhere around there, less than Return of the Jedi, which had been made 7 years prior. And so it was a, you know, granted Star Wars has more effects in it, of course, but it was not a lot of money. There has to be trims that are made, and what happens is parts of the script start being reworked. One of the big differences is the film opened up with a very, very interesting, about 10 minutes, 8 minutes, and, you know, however long it would have run, the sequence where we meet Kirk. He's with Carol Marcus. And they're in his apartment. He's retired, and they're, you know, making googly eyes at each other. And a courier comes to the door, and that was the role that was going to be played by Christian Slater. And the courier was going to tell Kirk, basically give Kirk a pad. Kirk was going to look at it and be like, you know, are you kidding? And then Carol gets it. You're being reactivated. And there's a really great line in the script where the courier goes, you know, sir, do you want me to wait while you get into uniform? And Kirk quotes Thoreau and says, you know, beware of enterprises requiring new clothes, which was a great, you know, great line. So the two of them then go off, and Kirk goes and meets each of his crew. So you get, he goes and meets, Scotty is a teacher at the academy, teaching about the bird of prey and, you know, the cloaking device to cadets, and Uhura runs a talk show radio program, and Chekhov is playing chess with a, unbeknownst to him, with a telepath, which is why he's losing. And he goes gets Dr. McCoy, who's drunk at a medical party where he's, you know, telling all these young doctors how much of an idiots they are. And, you know, when you look at the budget of that, you know, Chekhov's outfit, his civilian clothes, would have cost $3,000. Just the clothes themselves would have been an enormous budget, let alone reconstructing, you know, 23rd century Earth, which was something the original films couldn't do a lot of because of the limitations of budget and time and special effects. So that sequence in its entirety is just taken out of the script and replaced with a one line where Scotty says, you know, it suits me just fine. I bought a boat. You know, there's like a one line reference, Uhura, and, you know, I'm supposed to be chairing a conference. I mean, it's a couple lines of dialogue replace that whole thing. And that has to be taken out. Also, Kittimer was supposed to have a much bigger opening ceremony. You were going to see parades and this, all this pageantry as the speeches began, and that's, you know, all reduced to a matte painting, of Kittimer, and you see some Klingons standing there. So it's this there's portions of the script that are changed. The other big change is the original version of the script has Savick as the bad guy. There's no Valeris in the script. It's Savick. And it's pretty much word for word the same dialogue, except there's a little more animosity between Kirk and Savick because they have a pre-established relationship with each other. There are some differences. Obviously, they don't need to introduce her as the first graduating in her class or who Savick is and that sort of thing in the script. But Christy Alley, the actress who played the role originally, was who Nicholas Meyer wanted because that was his Savick, and he had cast her as Savick, and she wanted to do it. Unfortunately, the very short window of production time they had, she couldn't because she had already committed to a film. So instead of recasting it again, he created a new character named Eris. Well, actually, named by Kim Cattrall, Eris. And then Nicholas Meyer added the vowel to it to give it a sort of Vulcan sounding ring. And Kim Cattrall was the one of the original choices for Savick back in for Wrath of Khan. So it came full circle. And Kim Cattrall was very involved in the look of the character to differentiate it from Savick. So although the script is done, there's still lots of changes and trials and tribulations that they face until they actually start filming. They begin filming August 16th, 1991, and they have to finish filming by July, and they do. They finish July 2nd, 1991. So they also have a very short window in which to film the movie.
Is it April 16th?
Yeah, April 16th, okay. They start the film, and then they finish July 2nd.
Okay.
Production, and then of course they move right into post production.
So July, so that's like 5 months before, and I know that things are different now than they used to be, but like 5 months before release, whereas now what? I think they said they're going to be finishing up in like September or something like that, probably, which is still like
right.
8 or 9 months before release. So,
and of course, and where they can ship footage, you know, beam footage instantaneously back, and editing can begin, right? Editing and special effects can begin as soon as they've processed the, you know, there's no processing as soon as the film is beamed over. So, I mean, I think, are brought over, is it just loaded into the computer if it's not a digital film, or if it's a digital film, it's just beamed there. So it's a totally different world, where, you know, there's no models being made for most Hollywood films today that aren't CG models. And so they had to construct new models and also refurbish the old models in addition to filming those models. I mean, all that work had to be done and much of it done, you know, post-production.
Okay, going back a little bit. I'm sorry. I'm always going back a little bit, but this, like, there was so much information and, you know, things and little points or whatever. The idea of bringing Savick back is really interesting, and the idea of bringing Kirstie Alley back is really interesting. And I sort of love the sort of, like, you know, punk nature of that decision, like, screw those movies, I'm gonna get my Savick. But I think that that's kind of interesting. I'm surprised that the studio would go along with that.
Well, there was resistance, particularly by Gene Roddenberry, who had felt that by that time Savick had become a beloved character. And that by having that character be the saboteur, you were in essence putting a pall over, you know, her previous appearances. And I think there's certainly truth to that. I can understand, though, the desire to have a character that really would surprise you be the saboteur. Because, right, I mean, in a way, when you watch Star Trek VI, although to me it's you know, fantastic, and you know, I go back and forth depending on my mood, which is my favorite Star Trek film, but it's either 2 or 6, you know, depending on what day it is. And I love 6, but, you know, you do sort of know that it has to be Valeris. I mean, in a way, right? I mean, it's because she's a red shirt in a different way in this film, where she stands out as the new character and therefore is likely the saboteur. But luckily, they're smart enough to put in other surprises, right? Where you have a Klingon bird of prey that is invisible. I mean, there's enough in there where you're just like, cool. Okay, cool. And I think it would have been more powerful had it had been Savick, because you really truly would have been surprised. I mean, it would be like making, you know, Snoopy, you know, an evil character or something in the Peanuts movie. It would have been a genuine surprise. I wish in a way that had happened, but I like Valeris. I think she's an interesting character. And I think they're able to play that differently. You know, Spock and Savick, in the books, when they marry each other, I always find that to be, frankly, kind of creepy. Because my understanding of the conception of the character, and certainly the way that it's presented in Star Trek II, is not a romantic relationship. It's a father-daughter relationship. And he rescues her as a little girl, you know, from her planet. And I never understood that that line within the books where they got married. But Valeris, she's got a flirtation with her. I mean, you could see that, you know, which then you have that payoff of that Vulcan mind meld, which is so violent and played in a way that you see this intimacy between the two characters, but it's forced, and it's just, you know, really a scene where you start, you know, going, oh my gosh, you know, what does this all mean? And then I don't think with Savick that would have played in a different way. That would have been like child abuse, you know. I mean, it just, so I think, you know, it's good that she wasn't in there, but it would have been interesting had she been in there.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So, okay, so I forget where we're at now. I know that the movie had been canceled, but then they found the money, right? And now it's back on track, right? So
back on track, they're filming, yeah, and they're bringing in some really great people to work on the movie, who really contributed a great deal to it. You know, I think as much as the actors deserve credit for any Star Trek production, all the behind the scenes artists, you know, deserve credit because they're, you know, they're the ones that are pulling the ropes that make the door open, you know, that makes us believe that the doors are, you know, operate on some sort of futuristic technology. But, you know, one of the people that they brought in was Hiro Narita, who was, you know, from Seoul, Korea, but he was, you know, came to Hawaii and he had trained at the San Francisco Art Institute. And he was a director of photography on Never Cry Wolf and The Rocketeer, some really great films. And so he was kind of used to dealing with, you know, big productions. And he really contributed a great deal to the film. You know, one of Nicholas Meyer's ideas, which we certainly see in 2 and in 6, also is the idea of bringing that nautical theme into Star Trek. And so for him, that Star Trek 6, you know, Star Trek 2 was the naval cruiser above the water two submarines rather was Star Trek 2, right? In the Mutara Nebula, they can't see each other. They're in essence underwater doing silent runnings. And then Star Trek 6, you have the Enterprise as the visible ship above the water. And then you have the submarine under the water, which is this hidden bird of prey. And it's that theme of trying to tie into the nautical imagery and also the nautical theme, subconscious themes of the film, is part of what Nicholas Meyer asks the design teams to do and the creative artists to do. So one of the things that Hiro Narita thinks of is to do spotty lighting, which is all over Star Trek VI, where you have lights shining down and otherwise you might have sort of darkness or there isn't a lot of illumination around a character. And that produces sort of a submarine naval feel to it, at least thinking of the Hollywood presentation of what we think of as a naval, you know, vessel. And it also was great because it hid the sets, right? You didn't need, when they're doing the whole CNC scene and Spock is talking about what had happened on the Klingon homeworld and Kirk is given his orders by the command, you know, you don't see, you know, a great deal of that set because of the spotty lighting that's used. And that's smart when you don't have a lot of money. It's a way to save money. So Hiro Narita was able to use the spotty lighting to meet the creative vision of the director at the same time it solved the budgetary problem. And he was also very big on trying to do practical effects in the camera. So when you see the assassins kill that Klingon guard and the Klingon guard kind of go spinning down the hallway, that was done in camera. And you know, Hiro Narita tried to do as much in camera as he could. And, you know, he was assisted by the first camera in the movie was a woman still working in the industry named Kristen Glover. She had worked on The Rocketeer, and she's a founder of a group called Behind the Lens, an association of professional camera women. And, you know, she was a talented camera, you know, operator herself. And she was the first camera on Star Trek VI. That's the first film in Hollywood history where a woman was the first camera. And she handles that camera masterfully. You know, that scene where Kirk stands up and goes fire and that camera pulls in, I mean, that adds so much to the sequence. And that's all, you know, Hiro Narita and Kristen Glover's work. So, you know, they deserve a great deal of credit for their contributions and also helping to keep the budget down.
Okay, I'm going to ask you what may possibly be the nerdiest question ever asked on a Star Trek podcast, so I apologize in advance. But I have to know, in your research, especially in regards to the camera department, was it ever revealed as to why they chose to shoot this movie in Super 35? Because it's the only Star Trek movie that has not been shot in anamorphic, and I'm dying to know why.
Yeah, you know what? I would recommend that there is actually a source that you can look at. I believe, if my memory is right, Cinefex did an issue on Star Trek VI. And in there, there was discussion of that, and that was a decision by Hiro Narita to film that way. And I think that was part, he talks about that. He talks about the challenges of filming it with that. If my memory serves, he felt it would bring a realism to it, and a kind, the kind of feel that they were looking for. But that was his choice. And they have a whole discussion of that with him in that. I can actually scan that for you and send it to you, so if you're interested in that.
I would be interested in that, because that's something which I've always wondered. And, yeah, don't even get me started on the aspect ratio of Star Trek VI. We'll just go on forever, so as Drew knows. But, yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. So they make the movie. Right. Stop me if I'm skipping over anything. But they make the movie, and then, I mean, were there any challenges in post production in terms of getting it out fast enough or anything like that? I mean, I know that was definitely a challenge on the motion picture, but did they kind of have a better handle on things this time around?
Well, I think they were, you know, at the production was a much smoother, certainly way smoother than the motion picture. I mean, they were rushed, but they had enough time to have a good time. And so, you know, they really had a talented team. Like, for example, one of the things I love about the way the film was made was that, you know, when you think of Ruapente and you take out the Alaskan scene, right, which was obviously filmed outdoors, second unit, you know, helicopter work, beautiful alien looking landscape. Take that out of the equation. And Ruapente, whenever you see them inside, they actually film that outside. And whenever you see them outside, they film that inside. So when they built a massive set in right near the Hollywood sign in Bronson Canyon. But it had no top. So when you see Kirk fighting and Kirk is, you know, punching out the, you know, well, kicking in the inappropriate area in the knee, you know, the horned alien, and when they have all the sequence in Ruapente, where Kirk is, you know, the alien wants his jacket and all of that, and that's all done outside. And the idea was to make it, and they filmed that at night, and the idea was to make it look like it was an indoor, underground cavern by filming at night, and that lighting would help them. But then when you see him fighting Mardia and they're rolling around, and then he turns into himself and they're fighting, that's all done on a soundstage. So whenever they're outside, they're inside. Whenever they're inside, they're outside. But that shows the, you know, that, and that wasn't a small set. I mean, that was an enormous set. And so you had a lot of talented people working on it. Herman Zimmerman, of course, worked on this film and repurposed many of the sets from Next Generation as a way to save money. So the president's office is 10 forward. When the president is talking to Azit Bor, he's you're looking at the bar. That's Guinan's bar. And then where Azit Bor is on the screen talking about her father, that's that painting that's behind Guinan in 10 forward. You know, the doors that open up in there are the 10 forward doors. The Kirk's quarters and Spock's quarters are Data's quarters. Yeah. You know, so they reused what they could reuse, but also created incredibly impressive sets like the Klingon courtroom and the Ruapente cave set and all of that. So, you know, they were a pretty well-oiled machine at that time. A lot of the people that worked on this film were either veterans of previous Star Trek productions like Herman Zimmerman, or were just professionals themselves who really brought that creativity that, you know, Nicholas Meyer talks about, the art thriving on creativity is one of his great ideas. And, you know, giving people a chance to work on these films gave them a chance to figure out, how do I produce something of high quality when I have very little to maybe to work with. And, you know, so it was a smoother production in that regards, even though there was, in a way, a bigger time crunch on them, probably than any other Star Trek film, I would imagine, with maybe the exception of the first film.
So the movie comes out, and I know that you were, I'm sure, there, you know, waiting anxiously on opening night. First movie, unofficially, by the way, first movie ever to have Dolby Digital surround sound. So that's interesting. But what was the reaction by you and everyone else when the thing came out? Like, do you remember where you saw it on opening night? Assuming you saw it on opening.
Yep,
night?
I saw it at the Skokie Theater, outdoor Skokie Theater, in Old Orchard.
Okay.
I clearly remember, you know, I saw it that night and I saw it the night after. And there are a couple of things I remember about it. One was I lost a bet. I really thought Kirk was going to die in this. And I got suckered by the ads that showed him being blown away. I lost the bet and had to pay for my friend's ticket. You know, I remember that. But I remember both opening night and the night after. The night after, I saw it at the Webster Place by DePaul.
Mm.
Which is across from the, you know, on Lincoln Avenue. And which I think was the old Biograph, wasn't it? I think wasn't that all Biograph? Anyway. Both nights that I saw it, the audience, when that last 15 minutes, when they're doing the countdown and you got Chang spouting the Shakespeare and you've got Cliff Eidelman's amazing music and just the tension, when that Klingon Bird of Prey blows up, the only other two times I've seen audiences react that way were Rocky, the end of Rocky, and the end of the first Star Wars when they blew up the Death Star.
Yeah.
The entire place erupted in applause when that Klingon, because you were just like, yeah, finally, you know, thank God, you know, it was brilliantly edited, excellent script, everything just came together. And I remember thinking, you know, I had every emotion that I guess you could have. I was thrilled that it was such a great film. I was sad that this was going to appear to be the last film, the last time I would ever see them together like that. But no disappointment, you know. There was nothing about it. I walked away except that, you know, hoping that this wasn't going to be the last one. And, you know, audiences really responded to this film. You know, made $95 million, which for a Star Trek film, you know, was only a few million shy of $100 million, which is not usual back then for a Star Trek film to break $100 million. And, you know, there were 126 films that were released that year in the United States, and Star Trek VI was number 15, highest grossing. So it was a very successful film financially. It was also successful, you know, it got Academy Award nominations for makeup and for sound editing. It got a Hugo nomination for Best Dramatic Presentation. It won the Saturn Award for Best Science Fiction Film, and always rates high in most lists of people's favorite Star Trek films. And a lot of that has to do with the script and the charm of the actors, and the way those characters interact with each other. I mean, by that time, not only did they know the characters, you know, we knew the characters, and Nicholas Meyer knew the characters, and just, it was just the interactions between those characters so smooth and nice and wonderful, that forget all the great action and intrigue and social commentary. It was like Friends, you watching Friends and feeling comfortable watching Friends. And I do wish that the film had gotten more attention. I think because it was released so close to Christmas and the end of the year, it didn't get as much attention as it deserved. And there's really no reason why this film wasn't as big as Khan, except, of course, Ricardo Montalban's presence added a dimension to Khan that you know, you couldn't replicate without him. But, you know, it's just a fantastic movie, and I like both editions. You know, I like the director's edition. And I think the director's edition, the additions that were made in that edition, sounds like a Seinfeld routine. They added to the script. They didn't detract from the script. You know, they weren't gratuitous. What was put back in the director's edition? I think. How did you? What were your experiences?
What about you, Drew?
Watching Star Trek VI for the first time?
Yeah. Did you see it in the theater?
Oh, heavens no. Okay. For some reason, my dad took me to see Star Trek V, but I don't think I saw Star Trek VI. I think that he was frightened that it would be like Star Trek V. And we'd have to watch McCoy put his dad down again. That was traumatic. I remember the only real vivid memories I have of Star Trek VI and seeing it is watching it on VHS at my friend's house. We would play with his Micro Machine toys and play Doom, and then when we weren't playing Doom, we were watching Star Trek movies. And I remember that being like the first time I watched it and was like, wow, this is a really good movie. But yeah. I didn't see it in theaters or anything like that. Mike, when was the first time you saw Star Trek VI? Was it right after Star Trek V?
No, it wasn't, because my aunt only had the first 5 Star Trek movies. So Star Trek VI, it had been released on video yet, but it wasn't yet priced for sale. So interestingly, like, I lived in a 2-flat, and we lived on the top floor, and my aunt and uncle lived on the bottom floor. And my aunt and uncle were gone. This was like a couple months after I had seen all the movies for the first time, except for, well, 6. My aunt and uncle were out of town for the weekend or something like that, and they had HBO. And I looked in the TV guide, and I'm like, oh, Star Trek 6 is playing right now. Let me go down and watch that. But it had started up like 20 minutes ago or something, so I came in basically like right after the dinner scene. I can't believe this. I'm ashamed of myself for doing that. I mean, today Mike would, you know, kill 13-year-old Mike for doing something that disrespectful or whatever. But yeah, so the first time I saw Star Trek VI was, yeah, 20 minutes in. But
completely out of context.
Yeah, but I really did like it, you know, so much so that, you know, like a couple weeks later, I rented it from Blockbuster so that I could watch the entire thing. And I bought it the day it came. I remember pre-ordering the video cassette from Musicland and getting it, you know, the day that it came out, because I liked it that much. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, now I think it's great. And as far as the director's cut is concerned, I do like the director's cut more than the theatrical cut, for sure. The only thing about it which annoys me is the little flashes of people, yeah, to let you know who they are. I think
that's,
they could have done
good.
That. They should have done that
with,
yeah,
the sound
effect. With sound
that's
effect
the
and the flash of whatever. They should have just done a quick like cut, you know, just sort of like a more abstract sort of like cutting,
like a subliminal kind of thing.
Well, like the Limey, you know, where it's like the audio and everything stays exactly the same, and you just have like flashes of these people, not with flash effects, but little. You literally are just like cutting in shots of these people and then cutting back, and it would be very sort of like, you know, 60s paranoia thing, which I think would be in keeping with, you know, the type of movie that it is and everything like that. That's my only gripe about it. I like the fact that it has a taller aspect ratio, and which you can now get in HD on iTunes, by the way, so there you go, people. But yeah, no, I mean, I do like the director's cut, I think, better than the theatrical, for sure. Yeah. Yes. So that's that. I mean,
it's interesting. The you know, looking at the film now, I've actually been fortunate enough to discuss this via email a little bit with Nicholas Meyer, and you know, the younger people that are coming today to the films and seeing it, at least from my ancillary, you know, anecdotal conversations are worth with fellow fans, Star Trek VI is, you know, there is no Cold War mentality among a younger person, right? Among an 18, 19-year-old, there's no memory of the Cold War and living with that. And so, it doesn't resonate about that with them, but it resonates with, I've asked, a lot of them see it as some kind of like Iraq metaphor theme about war ending and how war ends. So the general theme of the film stays the same, what happens when a war ends, but the Cold War aspect of it is lost a little bit to a more actual war mentality. So like they're seeing the Klingons more as characters over they had an actual war with one another. And the other thing that's been interesting is seeing how younger fans see, you know, we always talk about the viewing order of the Star Wars films, but in many ways, the viewing order of the Star Trek films can be adjusted to in a way, or you can watch them in a certain way. And, you know, 2, 3, and 4 are certainly a trilogy of films, you know, 1, 5, each following directly after the other. But you can also put 2 and 6 together. In a way where you skip, you know, you skip 3, 4, and 5, and I never recommend that, but I'm just saying you can skip it and put 2 and 6 together as a companion piece. Because of course the David arc carries through into 6 from 2 and also from 3. But there's sort of a carry through there. And I think it's interesting to put those two films together some night if people are, want to watch some Star Trek films, to watch 2 and 6 back to back and how you might feel about those, looking at those as if you were watching them for the first time.
No, I think it makes a great double feature. In a lot of ways, it is kind of like an alpha and omega in terms of, you know, those characters in the movies. And in a lot of ways, I mean, that's the other thing about Star Trek VI is it really is, I mean, for a show, and we've talked about this before, but for a show that never had like a series finale, it is the perfect series finale, you know?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. Just today we finished, I've been showing, Mary Jo and I have been showing our son Nikki all the Star Treks, you know, in order and everything. And we just finished the original show. We've been going out of order and letting him choose which series to start with. And everything.
Cool.
And we finished the original series today. His reaction was, but it didn't end. And I was like, well, first of all, back then TV shows in general didn't end because they didn't have arcs, right? And even if they did, like The Fugitive or something like that, they knew they were ending in such a way that they could produce a final episode or something that felt like a final episode. This really is a great send-off for the crew because we never did get that.
Has he seen the movies yet or not?
Yeah, Star Trek is always on in our house.
Yeah,
so I mean, when I say we're showing him the shows, you know, a lot of times we'll say, I've seen this one, and I'm like, well, that's all right, son, you're going to watch again.
get used to it.
And because it's an obligation I have as a good father. to raise you properly, but we're watching them sort of in order now and being dedicated to a series as opposed to sort of throwing it out for background or, when we're making a, you know, Star Trek model or something, when they throw a movie on. So he's seen all the movies. But, you know, I think sometimes he's seen them in the way that, you know, they're sort of on seeing them and not sat down and watched them, you know, he's gone to see the last two in the theaters and he's really sat down and watched 4 and 6 and, you know, most of like one E, I don't think he's sat through that yet.
So is that the next,
we're doing the animated, we started the animated show tonight.
Uh-huh.
We're already done. He chose Deep Space Nine first. Then he chose Voyager.
Mm.
Then he chose Enterprise, and that was where I sort of put my foot down and just said, you know what, Nick, I think I watch Enterprise after. I think you want to watch Enterprise after the original show because so many of the episodes are either sequels or references or explain something that you'll get more out of Enterprise if you watch the original show. So he agreed to that, and we watched the original show. We're going to do the animated show, then we're going to do the movies, and then we move on to Enterprise and then Next Generation. So that's our viewing for the next year and a half or so, whatever it's going to be.
Drew, he's going to finish the animated series before you do.
No, he won't. I watched an episode the other day.
Oh, good.
Because
good.
Of you.
All right.
Instead of watching Clone Wars, which I'm 4 episodes away from the end of, I watched an episode of the animated series.
Well, now you're going to make me feel guilty, but whatever. Okay. Well, to wrap this up, any final thoughts on Star Trek VI that you want to share, John, or does that pretty much cover it?
Well, I think it covers it. You know, I hope people, if that they enjoyed the look at the history today of it, and if they, you know, want to learn more about the making of it, there is that really great Cinefex article that was done back in 1991. You probably get it on eBay or something if people want to pick it up. There may even be, I think they may do those digitally. I can't remember.
Well, I know that there's been like a Kickstarter campaign of some sort in order to get all of them like in a digital realm of something. They've been trying to do that. And I think, I don't know if it happened yet or not, but I know they've been working on that for about a year now. So it might be out.
And I just realized too, I made a mistake. The discussion of there is the Cinefex, and that's mostly about the special effects. There is also an American Cinematographer magazine, and that's where they talk about the aspect ratio, if my memory serves. I don't want anybody buying something. I can't remember which of the two issues they talk about that in, but in one of those two, they both had dedicated, you know, extensive coverage of Star Trek VI. And, you know, Mark Altman wrote a book, The Making of Star Trek VI, too.
Oh, yeah? Oh, wow.
Edward Gross. I can't remember if he did with that one with him or not, but it was by Mark Altman, and it's a very good making of book too. So unfortunately that was an unofficial book. If I remember, my memory serves right, it was not, you know, it wasn't like Star Trek 5 or 2, which both had official making of books but it's a really good book. It's worth getting your hands on if you can, and really celebrating and thinking about the contributions of all the behind the scenes people. So I there are sources out there, and obviously the DVDs and Blu-rays have really good makings of on there. So there's a lot more out there about Star Trek VI and a lot more to learn. So hopefully people will enjoy doing that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I mean, it's kind of great, and you know, especially you know, for people who weren't able to make it to your convention appearances, to kind of get a taste of what those experiences are like, even if we don't get all the great pictures in the audio format. But you know, we're limited by audio, so you know. but I mean, great info and everything like that, and you know, it's nice to give some love to my favorite original series movie for sure. Yeah. But
well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, anytime you want to come back, we'd love to have you. So thanks again.
Thanks, guys. Always fun. Thank you.
It's always fun talking with John. He's just a wealth of information. If you want to learn more about him and talk to him, you can find him on Twitter at MJTenuto. Well, it was fun talking about Star Trek VI with John, but that's not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Well, it's very small and intimate, and you get to see, you know, a lot of people whose work you've come to admire or whatever. And I mean, that's what's kind of cool about it, the fact that it's in a hotel, it's at the Rio. And you know, everyone is staying there.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, really, she's following the Hasbrat, I think is really what it is.
Come for the revolution, stay for the Hasbrat.
But it's got to be fresh Hasbrat. None of that replicated stuff.
Like Daniel's like, at the watching the end of this episode, like tears are coming down the face. It's like, oh, it's the Hasbrat. It's so spicy. It's what it is.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew pew pew. I promise you that.
To the journey! I do have one honorable mention.
Name it.
Pox!
Oh, how could we not have a top five season five moments without Prax?
Warp 5.
It kind of like is akin to when fans saw the Galaxy class in The Next Generation for the very first time, and you had basically a crew and civilian complement of, what, over 1,000 people? About two-thirds of that complement were civilians and their families. So you actually did have teachers and scholars and scientists and their extended families on board.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
One of the things that amazes me about the score for Star Trek The Motion Picture is that he only had 50% of the movie available to him when he scored. So he was scoring an awful lot to scene missing, scene missing.
The 602 Club.
Where did he get the cloak from on the other planet? I really, really, really want to know. He shows up with the cloak.
He kind of fashioned it out of a rudimentary lathe.
Literary Treks.
It's a small point, but I thought it was really interesting to have here in the book because, again, that's what Star Trek Deep Space Nine has really always done for Star Trek, which is kind of make faith okay in the Star Trek universe and show how it's valid. And so I thought that was a really nice... It's a tiny point in the book, but I thought it was pretty powerful, at least for me, who is somebody who is a faith. So. Mm-hmm.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the
women
narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Keiko could totally beat the crap out of Rumpelstiltskin. This is so, like, I cannot buy this at all. That she's just sitting there being like, oh, my baby!
At the very least, she could throw a plant at him or something. Because we established in TNG that pot poo is a thing.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spreaker, or you can just stream from the website. Just visit trek.fm/podcast to get all the links. If you want to contact us and share your thoughts on today's show, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose Send Show and choose Standard Orbit. That'll come to both of us by email. You can also use the tab on the left-hand column of any page to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone. And you can talk to us and our other listeners at our Facebook group, The Babel Conference. In social media, you'll find our Facebook page at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. You can find Mike on Twitter at Mumbles3K, and you can find him on his website, CommentaryTrackStars.com, and you can find him right here on Trek FM on Commentary Track Stars. You can find me on Twitter at 005, DUBLEOFIVE. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring Standard Orbit to you each week, and our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive and Federation, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today, catch up on all those classic Star Trek books yet to read, and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Standard Orbit and Trek FM. We'd also like to thank Richard Rutledge Jr. and Renee Roberts for being our associate producers this week by supporting us on Patreon. You can find Richard on Twitter at RUT8972 and Renee at MRES_1701. If you want to join them in helping keep us in orbit, you can support us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find a list of donation levels, where you can get things like exclusive digital goodies, early access to episodes, access to our project managers, and even be listed as an associate producer for our shows. You can find out where the donations can go, things like covering the monthly cost of hosting and distribution, hiring an editor for our shows, and upgrading our equipment. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm, so check it out. Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Have a good week and keep on trekking. It is the will of Landru.
Mr. Chekov, take us out of orbit ahead
Walt, factor one.
Hi, sir.